It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, birthday celebrations may have been scaled back over the last year, but there's still room for cake and other great desserts for celebrations. We'll get some great birthday cake recipe advice in this week's edition of Food Friday. Now, when Americans are asked how much they trust Congress, the news media, religious groups, and other civil institutions, there aren't a lot of winners. The public's trust in most of those groups has gone down over the years, but one of them has improved its standing and maintained a good reputation with the public. That's the U.S. Armed Forces. Our next guest says other institutions could learn from the military when it comes to establishing trust with the public. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there groups and institutions that you trust more than others? Has your faith in any of those dwindled over the years? Why is that? If the military stands out as particularly trustworthy in your mind, let us know why, or if not, why not? And what do you think it would take to build up more trust in government institutions, in the media, in business? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Amanda Ripley is a journalist and author of the forthcoming book, High Conflict, Why We Got Trapped and How We Get Out. Her recent piece for the website Comet is called The Mystery of Trust. Amanda, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Well, with this asterisk of the U.S. military, which we'll get to in a minute, you write that the story of trust in America is mostly a story of scarcity. Can you talk about how widespread this decline of trust has been?
Yeah, for some reason, this has been one of the most well-studied questions in history. So we know from multiple different research organizations, I counted four, there could be others, that survey the public regularly about its confidence in different public institutions and their leaders. And, you know, it's just down, 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 or at least flatlining for most institutions, from banks to church to Congress to newspapers to big business. Trust has been on the decline for decades, and that decline has accelerated recently.
What are some of the reasons behind that? And I'm sure there are a lot of arguments about the reasons behind that.
Yeah, it's trust is so interesting to me because it's something that we study in a lot of ways and yet really don't understand at all. So it's like this kind of paradox. Like we know it's super important. We talk about it a lot, and yet we don't really understand it. There's something ephemeral about it. So certainly, some of the decline in trust has had to do with shifting norms over time as sort of institutions, traditions, organized religions, other things have become less all-powerful in our lives, or less powerful, I should say. Then there's more sort of questioning of those things. There's more open reporting on the failures of those institutions. And there's, I think, more of a sense that people are out for themselves. You know, whether that's true or not, there is really a sense, and this could have to do with, you know, lots of things, sort of free market economy, you know, reality TV, who knows? But there's this creeping sense that people are kind of, you know, not trying to serve the community or the public, but themselves. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but that does seem to have some percentage of it is true, the decline in trust. Some percentage of it is totally merited, right? And some percentage of it may not be, depending on the institution. So what those percentages are is a hard one to answer.
We'll dig more into those institutions that are struggling with trust. Let's get into that exception. The military, you say, has gone the opposite direction. Post-Vietnam, all these polls you mentioned show the military having very low trust. What has happened since then?
Yeah, this is like by far my most favorite kind of story to do. Is like you take a really hard, wicked problem that's kind of depressing and see, are there any outliers, any exceptions, you know? And there is this great shining exception. So the only large institution that Americans trust more now than they did in 1981 is the U.S. military. So this is even after nearly two decades of costly, destructive wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The trust has not wavered. And like you said, it's not like it was always this way, which is what makes it even more mysterious and interesting. The low point for Americans' public trust in the military was in the early 1980s. So in 1980, only 28% of Americans said that they trusted the people running the military a great deal. So that's very low. And now is at 60%. So you know, on the one hand, you could say, well, that's because of Vietnam, you know, that was a fiasco. In 1980, it was not that long after Vietnam ended. On the other hand, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan have not been walks in the park, and they've been extraordinarily expensive and costly in terms of blood and treasure, both here and in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it is a really interesting question. You know, how did this happen? How did the military go from being not trusted by the vast majority of people to being trusted even across party lines to some extent, which is unusual right now? And I have a few theories. It's hard to say for sure, but there are a few things that did happen between 1980 and now that seem to be important. But like I said, trust is mysterious. So I don't want to pretend that we know the answer.
Talking to Amanda Ripley, journalist and author, looking at trust in American institutions. It's gone down for just about all of them in the last few decades, except the U.S. military, where trust has gone up. Well, Amanda, one explanation you point to in your piece on Comment was the military as institutions and its leadership really tried to do things to restore trust. What did that look like?
Yeah, well, so a couple things happened. First, the draft went away, and we know that this mattered. It ended in 1973. It's hard to say, you know, why it increased trust, but it did seem to matter. And there's a couple different weird things at work there that seem a little bit contradictory. But on the one hand, you know, because there was no draft, the military was no longer a threat to people inside the United States, right? And people also knew less about it. So in 1950, more than one in every three men in America had served in the military. So they knew the good, the bad, the ugly about the military. And today it's more like one in eight men and one in 100 women. So most people do not have firsthand or even secondhand experience with the US military, which makes it, in some ways you could say, well, that would make it harder to trust, right? Because it's more distance. On the other hand, it makes it harder to know. And because we're not close to interacting with the military day to day the way people are in other countries, it's easy to sort of believe the hype, right, about the thing. But I don't think that's the full story. I mean, the other thing that happened is that, as you said, you know, the military very intentionally went through a period of difficult, painful, controversial reform in the 1980s. So that was no accident that happened during this low point of trust and culminated in something called the Goldwater-Nichols Act, which passed Congress in 1986. And there's just a bunch of things that happened to try to reckon with the fact that the military was no longer designed to do the things we needed. It was designed to do something else. And so it had to be updated, modernized, streamlined, operationally changed. And that's also true, I would say, of Congress or journalism or other institutions, that they are working right. They're working the way they were designed to work, but they no longer serve what we need, right? So it is encouraging in the sense that the military became more trusted by making itself more trustworthy. And that was a public process done through hearings in Congress. There was a lot of dissent within the military, as you might imagine, people who thought it was a terrible idea. There were a lot of things that did not get fixed in those reforms, particularly the expense of our military. But, you know, it's hopeful in the sense that, hey, look, sometimes things are not that complicated, right? If you want to be more trustworthy, you have to get more trustworthy. You have to do things that make people trust you more out in the open, which includes acknowledging the ways in which you may have failed in the past. There are three ingredients that most researchers agree have to do with, or sort of the building blocks of trust: ability, benevolence, and integrity, right? And so those are the three things that make people trust someone or something more or less. And so with the various reforms, including becoming an all-volunteer force, the military upped its ability, became more effective. This was particularly obvious with the first Gulf War, very effective by the measures of the time. And also, it seemed like there was integrity. You know, there was alignment between what the military said it was about and what it actually did. That's particularly true when you have sacrifice, right? So if people are sacrificing something, as people in the military are, then it's easier to believe that they have good intentions, even in a skeptical time like the one we're living in.
Okay. How would we port those lessons from an institution like the military to an institution like Congress, which gets pretty low ratings for trust and other things? You know, when you've got really two sides there who have a hard time agreeing on anything, how would you institutionalize that kind of change?
Yeah, well, I had the same exact question. Okay, let's put this into action. Like, enough talk, right? Like, I feel like we have a real crisis in this country, right? Like, we need to figure out a way to rebuild trust in this country. So one of the things that I did for this piece was interview Seth Moulton, who is sort of unusual because he has recent experience in both extremes. So he went from serving in the most trusted large institution in America as a Marine deployed to Iraq to serving in Congress, the least trusted institution, as a Democrat representing Massachusetts. So he's currently in Congress now. And when we spoke, you know, I actually thought calling him up that he was going to say something like, well, you know, both institutions have good and bad and there's well-meaning people and, you know, it's misunderstood. I don't know why I thought that, but that's what I thought. I thought it would be really gray. But no, that's not what he said. What he said was, yes, there are huge differences between these institutions. He said, when you sign up for the Marine Corps, one of the first lessons you learn is you can fail a test or drop out of a run and they'll let you try again the next day. But if you lie about anything, you're out that afternoon. Trust is fundamental to the experience of being in the military, he said. And that's not the case in Congress. And it's a shame because trust should be fundamental to Congress and to all politics. So he really did say that, you know, this institution, Congress, the incentives are such that they don't actually support ability, benevolence, and integrity, right? They do other things. So the military is more trustworthy than Congress. It's not just our imagination, although certainly politicians have amplified, right, those feelings of distrust to serve their own ends at certain points. So the other thing he said, though, is that, you know, it's not inevitable. There are reforms we could make to Congress to make it fundamentally more trustworthy. So he talked about campaign finance reform. He talked about term limits. He talked about national service as an idea that Americans could have a common experience serving together like other countries have, which has come up many, many times in Congress, but not passed. You know, I would add to that things like ranked choice voting, which is where you get to vote for your top three favorite candidates instead of just one. So there's different things we know from other countries and from research make people heard, even if their candidate doesn't win, and make Congress and politicians more accountable to serving the public and not just having to fundraise and beat the other side, right? So right now, the system is doing what it's designed to do, and that design is no longer working.
We're talking to journalist Amanda Ripley right now about public trust in America's institutions, why it matters, and why the military has been able to keep, even build the public's trust when groups like Congress, the media, business, banks, and more have not. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there institutions that have lost your trust over the years? Big business, elected government, the media? What can be done to build that trust back up? With Congress, we're focusing on that some. What, in your mind, would make it work better, would make it earn people's trust? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation. Get to your calls coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Amanda Ripley. Her latest piece for Comment looks at how institutions gain or lose public trust while the military has grown in trust while groups like Congress have not. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering what the military can or will do in terms of maintaining their trust as more stories of how white supremacy has infiltrated the ranks, and what that will mean for the country and trust, and how the military, if they will address it, and what they can do to address that, to maintain that level of trust that they've earned.
Lisa, thanks for that call. And Amanda, you wrote that one of the many things the military did to try to build trust had to do with race and representation in its ranks. Is that still a battle they're fighting today?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a lot at stake here. You know, you can lose trust very quickly, to the caller's point. We've seen this a couple of times recently. And I think the threat of having extremists in the military is not a new one for the United States, but certainly goes up and down as extremist movements increase. And right now we're going through an increase. So that is a real concern. There were moments during the breach of the Capitol on January 6th in the video where you could hear people reciting the oath that people take when they join the military. You know, that's frightening. And in their minds, perhaps they were thinking that they are defending the country, defending the Constitution, which they felt had been violated because they're listening to news and politicians who are telling falsehoods, right? Who are spreading propaganda. And so that's very frightening. And it's very frightening, I think, to a lot of military leaders and veterans and members, because they realize how much there is to lose. You know, on June 1st, authorities used pepper spray, tear gas, rubber ball grenades, and batons against U.S. citizens in Lafayette Square in front of the White House in D.C., where I live, clearing the mostly peaceful protesters before a presidential photo op, as people may remember. And the there was an army general there. The nation's top military officer joined Trump on this, like, really cringeworthy walk through the park wearing combat fatigues. And so suddenly Americans got to see the U.S. military up close and threatening the way citizens in other countries sometimes have. And it was a real breach of trust. So the thing is, to their, you know, in their defense, the military does understand, the military's leaders do understand trust better than the leaders of many other organizations. That's a huge sweeping generalization. But as evidence, let me point out that 10 days later, that same general apologized. He said publicly, "I should not have been there as a commissioned uniformed officer. It was a mistake that I have learned from, and I sincerely hope we all have learned from. We who wear the cloth of our nation come from the people of our nation, and we must hold dear the principle of an apolitical military." So there is an awareness of this. That doesn't mean that there's not a problem. There is a problem. And there's a lot at stake because, you know, we look around now after that breach of the Capitol, what happened? We called in the military, right? We had, what, 15,000 guardsmen here in D.C., which is just a crazy number. So if we lose trust in the military, then it's unclear what we've got. But we also don't want to be naive about that trust.
Thanks for that call, Lisa. We'll go to Gary now in Tomahawk. Gary, hi.
Hi there. Hey, thanks for taking my call. A lot of what I look at is hidden agendas. And what I'm not getting from any of these kind of government agencies, if it be military, the Congress and such, as well as even media, that I don't get the facts. Instead, I get opinions and hidden agendas of individuals or corporations or groups. And I just love to hear the facts. And I think everyone would enjoy the facts so that we can make the choice of what is really happening.
Gary, thanks a lot for the call. Amanda, Gary, seeing facts overshadowed by opinions and agendas.
Yeah, and I hear that a lot, actually, particularly with regards to the news media, is there's this real sense that people have an agenda and they're not revealing what it is. And it's not a good one. Whatever it is, it's not serving the public. So I think some of that these institutions have to own, including my profession, right? So for not being transparent enough about our motivations, about how the public is manipulated, about how the business of media works. And there's in that failure to be transparent, you really open the door to a lot of misinformation and fear, right? So because there has been manipulation, there has been, you know, sensationalism and clickbait and all these things are real. And then it becomes like it can get bigger, right? So politicians and other media outlets exploit that and they say, they exaggerate it and they say that reporters are, you know, out to destroy the country and they don't care about freedom and these kinds of things. So it opens the door to distrust. And then it gets worse and worse and worse. You know, I just had somebody I know on the right send me a bunch of tweets, you know, complaining about how the mainstream media doesn't follow important stories. And they were like tweets pulled from different things, all of which, you know, I could source back to mainstream media coverage. And it's not to say that he's, you know, an idiot. He's not. You know, it's just that once you have that level of distrust, and once it is inflamed on purpose by media competitors and by politicians and pundits and platforms, then it really becomes like a slippery slope. You know, it's hard to get that trust back. And so I do think that the news media has to dramatically change what it does in order to be much more upfront about what our agenda is, or what any reporter's agenda is, or what the business side is, and what our motivation is from one moment to the next.
In our last minute or so, Amanda, do you have thoughts for how individual people, individual Americans, can help to try to rebuild trust amongst one another, regardless of what's going on in their institutions?
Rob, that is like, I actually think I should have, you know, focused more on that in the piece. Now that you say that, I'm thinking, man, that is so true. It's not just about how we distrust our institutions, right? Which is super important for sure. I mean, you can't function, as we have seen now. You can't function. You can't solve the problems that we could solve, that we all want to solve, that there's agreement on. You can't do it when there's this level of distrust. So it's really paralyzing. And it mirrors our distrust for one another, right? So this is really interesting. There's a lot of research on social trust. How do we feel like we can trust random strangers or our neighbors? And that too has gone down. One thing that gives me a little bit of hope is that we have seen those numbers go up in certain other countries, like the Netherlands is an example. So it can change over time. It's not the kind of thing that just goes down, 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 and never goes back up. But then to answer your question, you know, what could regular people do to increase trust? I mean, I think part of it begins with not inflaming the situation. So like I personally, just speaking for myself, I no longer repost, or I try not to repost or retweet or put things on Facebook that that just outrage people, that just enrage people, that are just designed to make me feel like I'm spreading around some pain or some shock, right? I feel like that's been done way too much. And I try to be much more personal in the way I talk, particularly on Facebook, and try to, in my work, share stories of people trying to solve problems, because that is happening all around us. We know this in our neighborhoods, in our schools, in our churches. We know that there are good people trying to fix the problems that we're grappling with, and they don't always succeed, right? But
we'll leave it there. Amanda, thanks as always for joining us. That's Amanda Ripley. Her new book coming out this year is High Conflict, Why We Got Trapped and How We Can Get Out, or How We Get Out. We'll talk about that later this year. We've been talking about trust. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. For a day that only comes once a year, making a cake can be a special treat for yourself or someone you care about for a birthday celebration. We can't celebrate with big groups in person right now, but we can still enjoy that birthday cake. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or your family have a go-to cake or dessert that you gotta have on the birthday? What is the best birthday cake you've ever had? Do you find joy in the simple tradition of making or eating cake? Have you celebrated a birthday during the pandemic? What dessert did you make? Did you drop it off for somebody and then eat it together over Zoom, say? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Deb Perlman is a creator and author of the food blog Smitten Kitchen. She's the author of two cookbooks, The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook and Smitten Kitchen Every Day. Deb, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, do you have a memorable birthday cake, one that you went to maybe when you were growing up?
You know, I have always loved the classic yellow cake, which is like such a funny thing to call it yellow, but it's that kind of golden color. I always loved a vanilla cake with a good fudgy chocolate frosting and filling. That was my classic go-to. But I can be a friend of many other types of layer cakes too.
Now, I know you're in touch with a lot of people who like to eat all manner of food. Are people, do you get the sense that people are making that celebratory birthday cake or whatever their dessert of choice is, even if they can't, you know, share it with 10 or 20 loved ones?
I think so. In fact, it's a little bit like we have more time at home and we're all doing a little bit more cooking sometimes than we want to, but most of us are doing a whole lot more cooking than we were this time last year. And we also, have a little bit more time because most of us are working from home to make cakes. And so I'm definitely seeing it. I'm definitely seeing an interest. I get a lot of questions about how do I scale this down or could I make this a one layer cake? And I am here for you. I have answers to all of these questions.
And I know this is a subject near and dear to your heart. You've got a lot of cakes on your website, and you've got a whole party cakes section in Smitten Kitchen every day. What is it about the cakes and the birthday desserts that that really appeals to you?
I really feel like, well, my theory is that most birthday cakes, and this is probably pre-pandemic, but not necessarily untrue for now, are made at like 11:30 p.m. the night before you remember it's somebody's birthday.
I've been
And
there.
I love a very ambitious cake, when you have time, but most of us just want somebody to feel special on their birthday. And so I wanted to develop a series of one bowl, really great, like airtight recipes for cakes with simple ingredients you already have around that you could use in different ways. So the party cake builder in my in Smitten Kitchen every day does exactly that. We start with this idea of either a 9-inch round or an 8-inch square one layer cake with a thick raft of frosting on top. You can turn that cake into, you can double it and make a two layer cake, a regular layer cake. You can turn it into 12 cupcakes, or you can even double it and turn it into a sheet cake in a 9 by 13. Or you can, if you happen to have smaller cake pans, which are one of my favorite things to tell people about, especially as we're doing smaller gatherings and, mini cakes right now, is that all 9-inch round and 8-inch square cakes can be halved in a 6-inch round cake pan, which are a great investment. They're very inexpensive online. You can buy sets of them if you want to make smaller birthday cakes. So you could take one 9-inch round cake and turn it into a two layer 6-inch cake. I hope I didn't just do too much math. I feel like all the non-math people just like slammed the door and left the
Wait,
room. But
cut it in half,
it's
6-inch
so
cake. I
simple.
got it. We're
I was
talking to
like the
Deb
6, the
Pearlman.
12, the 9, the 9.
Talking to Deb Pearlman on this edition of Food Friday. We are making birthday cakes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Deb blogs at Smitten Kitchen. She's got a couple cookbooks with Smitten Kitchen in the title. We've got recipes from Deb at WPR.org/Food Friday that has made the Central Time team really hungry for cake. Let's check out, before we go to our callers, Deb, let's check out one of those recipes. Straight up, best birthday cake. You thought, those box mixes, they're pretty good, but you wanted to make your own classic birthday cake. What's the secret?
Vanilla, butter, buttermilk gives it a little bit more of a dynamic flavor. Without artificial flavors in it. And on that cake, I do a kind of not really a classic buttercream. I do a little bit of an unusual frosting where you use sour cream and melted chocolate. But hear me out. It makes a really glossy, smooth, shiny, fudgy frosting. And I really love it. But I also have recipes for classic chocolate buttercreams if that's more your speed.
It looks really good. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Joshua is with us in Milwaukee. Joshua, hi.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what is your secret favorite cake?
I mean, growing up, I was always into Funfetti, and I think that's always been a fan favorite, especially just in my family. But we were trying to figure out how we can kind of move away from the box and start making it from home. So my wife has actually found a recipe by Molly Yeh, and she's got an amazing cookbook, and they have a homemade Funfetti. It's just so much fun. It's super colorful, and just it reminds me of the boxed one, but it tastes so much better.
And Joshua, before you go, Funfetti, that's the one. It's like a normal looking cake, but it's got sprinkly colors. It's not like fettuccine. That's not the fatty part.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a
Yeah,
white cake with a bunch of sprinkles, which brings me
yeah.
right back to being 8 years old.
All right. Do you still eat it even though you're not 8 anymore?
Oh, all the time. Every
All the time.
birthday, I ask my wife, like, let's make that Funfetti. Let's go for it.
Excellent. I love it. Deb, have you tackled the secret of Funfetti?
I do. I actually have my own version of it on my site, but I've also made Molly Yeh's before, and it's wonderful. It's a happy cake. It's so happy. And whether or not you have kids or you just like colorful things, it's just the difference between a white cake and a colorful white cake. And I think we can all use more color in our lives right now. Here, you guys have quite a bit of snow out there, so.
We do. We do. And it doesn't have sprinkly colors in it. Huh. Interesting.
Yeah,
Joshua,
I
thanks a
know.
lot for that call. We'll go to Scott now in Appleton. Scott, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
So what's your cake, Scott?
It's a peach cake that my wife makes for me every year. In fact, my mouth is salivating at talking about it. It's made from scratch from the red and white covered cookbook. But basically what makes it different is she puts in a can of peaches with the syrup in it. And then mixes that into the mix and then bakes it and everything. And then we top it with a whipped topping. And it is so moist. And the Cool Whip topping just kind of gives it that creaminess with it. It's delightful.
Fantastic. I love it, Scott. That sounds great. Deb, any tips or suggestions on making something like that?
Yes, you should make some for me. That sounds amazing.
I love
a birthday cake with fruit in it. I'm not only loyal to chocolate and sprinkles, and I love like a nice summery cake with chunks of peaches. I think it's just the happiest thing.
Thanks a lot for that call. Before we go back to callers, I want to get to another recipe you shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. If somebody really wanted to make a cake for, I don't know, public radio host, this would be a good one. The chocolate peanut butter cake. Now, you say beware, serve in thin slices. It's super rich. This is right in my ballpark. Tell us about this chocolate peanut butter cake.
This cake is completely over the top. It is, it's a three layer. It's a kind of an old fashioned cake, like a kind of a devil's food cake is the actual cake. So if you like those really like moist, dark crumbed chocolate cakes, this is definitely for you. And then the filling and frosting are a peanut butter frosting. And it's a peanut butter cream cheese frosting, which I know sounds very unusual, but the extra tang of the cream cheese really brings the peanut butter together. Like it tastes so much better than just peanut butter and sugar would. And then on the top, we have a chocolate peanut butter glaze. And it's an amazing cake. And it's one of the earliest cakes I put on my website. And I remember it broke my servers at the time. Like it was just, there was too much excitement over chocolate and peanut butter. And I learned my lesson after that, but it makes a really large cake, which may not fit our lives right now. You know, it makes a three layer 9x9 inch cake. So you could have it in 6 inch pans, or I've also made it as a single layer sheet cake too. But then you don't get those stacked layers.
Oh, that looks so good. Back to our callers now. Barb is with us in Jackson County. Barb, hi.
Hi, my son's going to be 40 years old this year, and when he was a little boy, he would confuse cake and pie. And because his birthday's July 6th, we always have fresh strawberry pie with whipped cream, and we put candles on it, and that's his birthday cake every year since he's a little boy.
Now, hold on. Do you call it pie, or do you still call it cake because it's the birthday cake?
We call it birthday cake, but we laugh about it. And now he has three little kids, and so we call it Daddy's birthday cake. But and then we tell him he used to call it, you know, cake when he was little. So
awesome.
It's kind of a family thing, and you know, because it's July 6th, he gets fresh strawberries.
I love the tradition too, Barb. Thanks a lot for that, Deb. Any favorite celebratory pies that we could pretend are cakes if we want to?
I would definitely love a strawberry pie in the summer anytime. I love a peach pie. I have a lot of friends who prefer pie over cake too, and we often make them pies for their birthday. Well, you know, in other years, perhaps hopefully by the summer, but we'll see. But yeah, I feel like in the middle of the summer, it's really nice. If you've got fresh fruit or you were able to go peach picking or you have berries, it's, you know, it's a fun thing to make a big pie.
Awesome. Thanks a lot for sharing that story. We're talking to Deb Perlman, creator and author of the food blog Smitten Kitchen. She has two cookbooks out, including Smitten Kitchen Every Day. We're talking about birthday cake or birthday pie, whatever your birthday dessert of choice is. You can call in at 800-642-1234 to share your favorites and maybe the transition that goes along with, or the tradition, excuse me, that goes along with it. And let us know how you've adapted, if at all, during the pandemic to making those cakes and pies when there's not as many people gathering in person for them. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Deb Perlman, creator of the blog Smitten Kitchen, author of two cookbooks, including Smitten Kitchen Every Day. We are talking about birthday cakes and other celebratory desserts. You could join in with your favorite and the tradition behind it at 800-642-1234. Get a few recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. Deb shared a straight-up birthday cake with some twists, a chocolate peanut butter cake, and a vegan coconut cake. Maybe we'll get to that in a bit as well. But right now, let's go back to your calls. Ricardo is with us in Madison. Ricardo, hi.
Hi. So I have three. One of them is for sure for birthdays. It's tres leches cake. For Halloween, we also have pan de muerto, which translates bread of death. But it's really, really popular in Mexico. And then I also have another one that it's called La Rosca, which we usually celebrate it after Christmas. In fact, for Los Tres Reyes Magos, which is usually January 5th. So, yeah, I just wanted to share those three.
That's fantastic, Ricardo. Thanks for that. The birthday one was tres leches. We also heard from Brandy on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Brandy says, I have a thing for tres leches cakes. The best ones are at Mexican bakeries. I have made tres leches cake. It's been a while. I really like them. Deb, any thoughts on that?
It's a favorite of mine, too. I feel like I've now listed five favorites and somebody's going to call me out, but I'm allowed to have as many birthday cake favorites.
I'm right there with you, though.
I've definitely done tres leches before, and it's just so delicious, and people are so excited about it. And you can even have fun with it and add like a fourth one and add some coconut milk in, but I feel like even just the three are wonderful. It's a really lovely cake, and it keeps really well if you're trying to like plan ahead for having people over in some, you know, other year.
Awesome. Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Bruce with us now in Eau Claire. Bruce, hi.
Hey, gang. Yeah, I grew up in a household of five kids. Mom made a lot of birthday cakes. And our favorite was Jell-O cake. You take your favorite Jell-O, mix it with fresh fruit, and blend it in with Cool Whip graham cracker crust. We liked it so much that when it was Mom's birthday, we made her make it for that as well.
Wow. Okay. Nice, Mom. I hope she liked it, too. Bruce, thanks a lot for that. She did? Good. Glad to hear it. Thanks a lot for that. That's, I don't know, sounds like kind of an easier one to pull together, Deb. Do you do much with Jell-O in your desserts?
I haven't, but I've definitely heard about this kind of cake before, and I know it's really beloved among people who grew up with it. I missed out. I'm going to talk to my mom right after this and ask her why she hasn't made it for me.
Excellent. Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Well, I foreshadowed this a bit. The third recipe you've got for us at WPR.org/Food Friday. Deb, a vegan option, which you usually don't do reading this recipe, a plush coconut cake. What's the key to making this vegan cake appealing even to the non-vegans out there?
It is. So I'm clearly not vegan, as we've talked about tres leches and eggs and butter and everything else. But I came across, some people know them as depression cakes. They're this really like old fashioned way of making cakes, I guess, when eggs were harder to get, or maybe butter. And so they're made with oil, flour, and there's no weird ingredients in there. They just work. It's like some baking voodoo, and you don't need eggs and you don't need to use butter. You do use some cooking oil. And it makes these incredibly plush, moist cakes. Like you don't need to eat it because you're vegan. You're going to eat it because it's like one of the most amazing cakes you'll ever eat. So I was playing around with that formula, and I wanted to, the coconut cake has been really popular on the site. Once again, it doesn't use any eggs or dairy in it, but like you would not know from eating it that you're missing out on anything at all.
Okay, I think I'm going to try a couple callers back to back here, starting with Travis in Mercer. Travis, hi.
Hi, I had a quick question. I made a banana cake last week with a maple syrup and cream cheese frosting, but I just thought it needed a little something else on the frosting, like some candied nuts or something. I was just wondering if you had any advice on that.
Okay, hold your thought there, Deb, because Rob in Verona is also in the banana cake territory here. Rob, hi.
Yeah, what a coincidence. Yeah, banana cake's been kind of a tradition in our household for a while now. I can't remember where the recipe came from. I want to say it came out of one of Penzi Spices publications, but you can probably find it on the internet. But it's like a almost like a banana bread recipe. It's very similar. For the frosting that goes with this cake that they recommended, it was a mocha frosting, and it's like a chocolate mocha frosting. So you make it with, actually, I think it has like a cup of coffee, strong coffee in it. What I did in a pinch one time, I made it, and I didn't have time to whip up the frosting. And so I improvised and grabbed a jar of Nutella out of the cupboard and thought, this might work, and put it on there. And on the warm cake, it kind of melted it up. And it was outstanding. And so now that's almost more my go-to frosting for it. And now it doesn't exactly kind of match up with what your colors kind of suggested. But, yeah, you could do some nuts on top of it. But, yeah, you can either go with that mocha chocolate frosting or even just as simple as Nutella. And to be honest, I think Nutella on just about any cake, it just acts like a chocolate frosting and a little bit of healthier.
All right. Rob, thank you so much. All right, a couple callers with banana cake and frosting thoughts. Deb, what do you like for frosting a banana cake?
Actually, I like all of those things. I feel like banana goes really well with coffee. It goes really well with chocolate. It goes really well with cream cheese. On the candied nuts that you mentioned, if you're looking for a fairly straightforward recipe, I have a recipe for sugar and spice candied nuts on Smitten Kitchen. I've often made them for gifts. But it's a really simple formula where you actually use an egg white and you whisk it up and you use a little bit of salt and sugar and you bake them together. And what it creates is like a really nice, crunchy, sweet, salty nut. It's mostly sugar, but with just enough salt to make it taste interesting, that they really keep forever in a jar. So you could make a pound of them, put some on the cake, and then have it for the next time. So I have to point you there. But I feel like bananas go really well with all of those flavors. And I was laughing about the Nutella because he would definitely fit in well here because my kids basically want Nutella on everything all of the time. And they often get away with it because their dad makes breakfast.
Excellent. Thanks for that. Those calls, I should say. Time for another caller or maybe two. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hello.
Hello. I once found a recipe that I definitely knew I wanted to try because it had a can of whole cranberry sauce in a chocolate cake recipe. It was just wonderful. And I would bring it to my work and tell people, now there's some kind of fruit in this cake, and I want you all to try to guess what kind of fruit it is. Nobody ever guessed that this was a can of whole cranberry sauce. And it gave this chocolate cake a richness and a depth, and the combination of chocolate and cranberries is just wonderful. And then I started branching out into melting chocolate bars and pouring it over a mixture of nuts and dried cranberries, and then broke it up into pieces after that cooled and hardened. And that was wonderful. Chocolate and cranberries just really do go together.
Fantastic. Nancy, thanks so much. I wouldn't have guessed about that combo, Deb. What do you think?
I think it sounds really good. I immediately Googled it, so I'm looking at a recipe. and I love it. And I'm feeling like it might be like a cousin to almost a Black Forest cake, where you might use a cherry sauce instead. Cranberries might be like easier for us to get here because they're a big American product. But I feel like this chocolate, berry, chocolate, cherry, it's a really nice combination because it really kind of wakes up the chocolate. I know it's not for everybody, but I think they go really well together.
Thanks for that call. And Deb, we'll leave it there. I think everybody's going to skip dinner tonight and go straight to the cake. Thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you for having me on.
That's Deb Perlman, creator and author of the food blog Smitten Kitchen. She has two cookbooks. Smitten Kitchen Every Day is the latest, includes a chapter on celebration cakes if you need to do more research. And we've got links to the recipes she shared with us today at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you can keep sharing your favorite birthday dessert traditions on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on Central Time, a Wisconsin sports writer shares his experience with COVID-19, including what he calls the worst 11 days of his life. And there's a lot presidents can do with executive actions, but there are also big limits. We'll look at the role of executive orders and related rules in the early days of the Biden administration. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Yesterday on the show, I talked about the palindrome days we're living through right now. Again, palindromes are words, phrases, or numbers that are the same forwards and backwards. So today's date, if you do it the five-digit way, 1-22-21, it's the same if you flip it backwards. And we are in a run of 10 palindrome dates. But after the show, I found out I had just scratched the surface of palindrome news. It turns out there's an annual palindrome contest, and they just released their winners this week. The awards are called the Simmys, S-Y-M-M-Y-S. It's a palindrome. Word expert Ben Zimmer was one of the judges, and he shared results at the Beyond Wordplay website. Here are a few of the winners. You have to trust that they are really palindromes. It's kind of hard to hear it on the radio. The winner for short palindrome titled Fact. Here it is. Tonsil is soft, fossil is not. Can't argue with that. The mid-length winner had a pandemic theme, as did some others. Here it is. Risk same cafe? Sure. Talk later. Use face mask, sir. Best long-form palindrome was a recipe for a ragu. It's too long. I don't have time to read it all now. And the winning poem was on a pandemic theme. Put it on, knot it up, walks a man in a mask. Law, put it on, knot it up. I tried to come up with a palindrome to end with. Turns out I'm not very good at palindromes. Wow, Bob. Wow. See, it's not good. I don't go by Bob. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.